Tonight we're going to talk about the first factor in the Eightfold Path, which is right view.
Hoje à noite falaremos sobre o primeiro aspecto do Nobre Caminho Óctuplo, que é a perspectiva correta.
The path starts with two factors that are related to discernment.
O caminho começa com dois fatores que são relativos ao discernimento.
The second factor is right resolve.
O segundo fator é a resolução correta.
Right view, you might call the head factor.
A perspectiva correta, você pode chamar que é o fator cabeça.
Because it's primarily about understanding.
Que é primeiramente sobre entender sobre as coisas.
Right resolve is the heart factor.
A resolução correta é o coração, é o fator do coração.
Because it deals with what we want based on how well we understand.
Porque ele lida com aquilo que queremos de acordo com aquilo que entendemos. Okay.
Now, as I said last night, the right view exists on three levels: mundane, noble, and ultimate. Last night we talked about mundane right view. I'll give you a brief account. Mundane right view deals primarily with the principle of karma, that we have actions and that our actions give results. Also deals with the principle of rebirth, that there are worlds that we can go to after we leave this world at death. The important part about karma, of course, is that even though our actions give results, they don't totally determine everything in our lives, because we have choices in the present moment that we can make to either behave even more unskillfully based on what's coming from our past actions, or behave more skillfully than we have in the past. The teachings on mundane right view are called mundane because they basically give guidance in how to find happiness in the worlds of rebirth. In other words, the different identities that you take on as you go from life to life, which, as we also commented last night, is called a process of becoming, where you assume an identity in a particular world of experience. I'd like to go over that topic of becoming a little bit more, because even though mundane right view is expressed in terms of becoming, we'll eventually find that the craving for becoming is our real cause of suffering. Or the cravings that lead to becoming are our causes of suffering. So it's good to understand what becoming means. As I said, it's taking on an identity in a particular world of experience. And this happens on many levels. First, there's the large level of becoming. Like, we're all human beings right now. We all have an identity as a human being in the human world. But even though we're all sitting here in the same room, we all live in different worlds. This has to do with our internal levels of becoming. The ideas that you take on, the worlds that you imagine in your mind, and then the identities that you take within those worlds. Now, all of these are based on desire. You develop an identity and you identify a world because you have a particular desire. And the world will be determined by what you desire. There are many things in the human world that may be relevant to your desire, and that will be part of that particular becoming. There may be other things that are irrelevant to that world, which are not going to be part of that becoming. And you can be shut off to many aspects of the world outside based on what your desires are. There was a cartoon that appeared in America several years back. A nuclear war is happening. You see atomic bombs going off on the horizon. People are running around like crazy. And there's this car driving through a city. And the car is stopped, and there's a dog in the car. And it looks outside, and there's another dog on the sidewalk. And in spite of all the activity going on, the caption is, "Finally something captured Scooby's attention." In other words, dogs relate to dogs. They don't relate to human beings quite as much as they do to dogs. Dogs live in a dog world, even though we share the same physical world. And it's the same with us. They say that an alcoholic will go into your house and very quickly pick up on where the alcohol is in the house, because that's part of the world that's relevant to what they're interested in. Other people who are not alcoholics will have no idea where your alcohol is. So the world that you live in is based on your desires, as is your identity that you take on in that world. There's the identity of you as the producer, who has the skills and able to bring about that desire. And there's also the identity of you as the consumer, the person who's going to enjoy the results of fulfilling that desire. As I said, mundane right view deals in terms of self and world based on trying to show your way to live in states of becoming in a way that is relatively painless, in a way that is relatively pleasant. But mundane right view also points out the fact that no matter how great the pleasure you take by taking on these identities in these different worlds, it always has its limitations. There will always be an end to that particular pleasure. And so its mundane right view gives you reasons for why you may want to take on another kind of right view that does not require becoming or does not deal in terms of becoming. And that's what noble right view will be. Because it tells you, basically, if you're going to find a happiness that lasts, you're going to have to put ideas of becoming aside. And it tells you why. And that way, you're more willing to drop your ideas about becoming and take on the Four Noble Truths as a guide. Okay, the Four Noble Truths, instead of focusing in terms of your identity in a particular world, focus on a particular problem, the problem of suffering, and particularly in terms of what are the actions that lead to suffering as a result, and what actions lead to an end of suffering. There's no need to relate to self or worlds in here. You're simply looking at the action and its pure result in terms of leading to suffering or not leading to suffering. We focus on this problem, and it's a question of priorities. The Buddha is not simply saying, hey, these are four interesting facts about suffering. He's saying these are the most important problems you can focus on. So there are other questions that he does not address at all. Who are you? Who created the world? All of which are questions that relate to becoming. The question is basically, what actions cause suffering? What actions can stop suffering? So the Four Noble Truths are actually four categories for dividing your experience. And it turns it out that each of these categories has a duty that goes along with it. First, let's talk about the categories. I'm going to talk first in detail about the first Noble Truth, which is the truth of, in Pali, dukkha, which means suffering or stress. Sometimes we hear that the Buddha said that life is suffering, and that's not what he said. He said something much more useful and much more specific. He started out by listing different kinds of suffering. There's the suffering of aging, illness, birth, aging, illness, death, being separated from what you love, having to live with what you don't love, not getting what you want. But then he, all of which are things that we are familiar with, but then he summarizes what all these different forms of suffering have in common. And this is where the analysis gets less familiar. He talks about five clinging aggregates. So we have to talk about what are the aggregates and what is clinging. The aggregates, as I said, are five. There's form, which means physical form. It can be the form of your own body, but it also can be external forms. There's feelings, which are feeling tones of pleasure, pain, neither pleasure nor pain. Perceptions, these are the labels that you apply to things. Say, this is a microphone, these are glasses. This is a light, the ideas or the names that you give to things. And then there are fabrications where you put thoughts together and say, basically, I like this microphone, I don't like these glasses, what you want to do with the glasses, what you want to do with the microphone, all of that is fabrication. And finally, there is consciousness, which is your sensitivity or your awareness at the six senses, counting the mind as the six. Now the question sometimes arises, why did the Buddha divide experience into these five categories? And it's important to note that they're all related to the process of feeding. Both physical feeding and, more importantly, emotional feeding. When you're feeding off a person, when you're feeding off a relationship, where you're feeding off particular ideas. To give you an example in terms of physical feeding, form, of course, would relate to your body on the one hand, and then the possible things out there that you could eat. Feeling has to do with the feeling of pain that comes with hunger, the feeling of pleasure that comes when that hunger has been satisfied. Perception plays two roles. One is identifying what kind of hunger do you have. Are you hungry for ice cream? Are you hungry for pizza? Are you hungry for a relationship? Are you hungry for wealth? You want to identify what you feel a lack, and you want to identify exactly what is the lack. And then you look outside to see if you can find something that would satisfy that hunger. And for many of us, as human beings, the role of perception gets started with our search for food. When a child walks across or crawls across a floor, encounters something, what is the first thing the child does? It sticks it in his mouth to see if it's edible. So the first perceptions we have in life are, is this edible? Is this not edible? And as we go through the world, we find things, we sort out more carefully what kinds of edibles there are out there and what kinds of hungers they can satisfy. All of this has to do with the process of perception, which are the labels that you apply to things. Fabrication has to do with what you're going to do with the food once you get it. Well, first, how to find it, and then once you've found it, what to do with it. Some forms of food cannot be eaten raw. You have to fix them. So your skills in learning how to fix food, all that has to do with process of fabrication. And finally, there's consciousness, which is simply aware of all these activities. So these are activities that are very close to our process of feeding, which is something very close to our heart, something very close to our stomach, of course, but also very close to our identity of who we feel we are. The way we feed off the world has a lot to do with our sense of our identity. You find people identifying themselves as vegan or vegetarian or carnivores or people who will eat this kind of food but will not eat that kind of food. But this has not only to do with physical food, but also mental food, what kinds of things you would do in order to gain the mental satisfaction that you want. The word for clinging, which applies to these aggregates, also means to feed. Upadana means to take sustenance off something. So you have two levels of feeding. You're feeding off the world, and you're also feeding off your identity of who you are. There are four types of clinging, and also four types of feeding. The first is sensuality. And as we have to keep stressing the point, sensuality does not mean just sensual pleasures. The pleasures in themselves are also often neutral. What we tend to cling to is our fascination with thinking about what we want in terms of sensual pleasures. We can think about that for hours and get really attached to that, our way of looking for sensuality. You keep adjusting things a little bit. This pleasure doesn't interest you anymore. Then you adjust it a little bit and find another pleasure. And just so you can think about sensual pleasures for long periods of time. And this, our fascination with thinking about sensual pleasures, that's the clinging. Then there's clinging to views. Views here, clinging to views would be, say, believing that by holding to a particular view, you're going to be saved. By believing in something, you're going to be saved. In other words, the view itself is enough to lead to happiness, or it will make you a better person. There's also clinging to habits and practices. And then there are certain ways of doing things that you feel you have to do, regardless of whether they give good results or not, but you hold on to them anyhow because you feel they're part of your identity. This is how you do things. You probably heard the song by Frank Sinatra years back, "I Did It My Way." Well, Frank Sinatra's way was pretty stupid. But he was very proud that he did it his way. Okay, that's clinging to habits and practices. I'll tell you a story. Those of you who are in the talk on Thursday night, bear with me because you're going to hear it. A story I gave you again that night. There was a famous biologist in Austria. His name was Konrad Lorenz. And he raised a goose one time. The goose gave birth to a young goose. The mother goose died, and so the young goose immediately fixated on Konrad Lorenz as its parent and would follow him around through the garden all through the summer. Now, as winter approached, he began to realize that this young goose couldn't stay outside at night anymore, so he had to learn how to bring him in the house. So one night, instead of feeding him what he normally did, he just walked into the house and left the door open. So the goose followed him into the house. Immediately, though, as soon as it got into the house, it freaked out. It had never been inside an enclosed space before. There was a window at the end of the hall, so it immediately ran to the window, thinking it could get out. When it realized, though, the window was closed, he couldn't get out. In the meantime, halfway down the hall, there was a stairway, and Konrad Lorenz had gone up the stairway to his apartment. So he called to the goose. The goose turned around, followed him up the stairs, and that's where he got to eat. So the goose got used to being inside. But then from that point on, every time it entered the house, it would first go to the window, then back up, and then go up the stairs. And as time went on, the trip to the window got shorter and shorter. And to finally, it would go to that side of the staircase, wave its foot at the window, and then run up the stairs. Well, one day, Conrad Lorenz came home late from work. And the goose was very hungry. So as soon as he opened the door, the goose ran into the house, ran up the stairs. Halfway up the stairs, though, it stopped. It started shivering all over. And then very methodically walked down the stairs, over to the window, back, and then back up the stairs. So that's clinging to habits and practices. You're listening to your inner goose. The final form of clinging is called doctrines of the self. You have certain ideas about what you are, who you are, what it means for you to exist, whether you exist or whether you don't really exist. All of these ideas come down to your doctrines of the self. In other words, you may identify yourself simply as a body, or you may identify yourself with your ideas. Most of us tend to identify either with body or with the mind, activities of the mind. But holding on to the idea, this is who I really am, that's a form of clinging, which is also a form of suffering. All of these forms of clinging are stressful. And it turns out even when we try to cling to the experience of awakening when we first have it, that too will be stressful, and that too will be get in the way of full awakening. However, as we're following the path, it is necessary to cling to the path so as to be able to let go of other paths that we might follow. And in this type of clinging, there is a role for three of the types of clinging. In other words, there's a role for view in terms of having right views. There's a role for clinging to habits and practices, the practice of virtue, the practice of concentration. And there is a role for clinging to a sense of self, the idea that you are capable and responsible and that you want to work for your long-term welfare and happiness. All of that requires a sense of self. So there are things that you will cling to in a more skillful way as part of the noble path. Eventually you let them go, but in the meantime you hold on. And John Chas tells a story, let me back up for a second, of the forms of clinging. There is no role for sensuality. That kind of clinging, the Buddha says, you've got to let go of, has no role on the path. But the other three forms of clinging do have a role on the path. And John Chas tells a story. You're coming back from the market, you're carrying a banana. Someone comes up and asks you, what are you going to do with a banana? Why are you carrying it? You say, I'm carrying it because I want to eat it. And it says, are you going to eat the peel? No. And why are you carrying the peel? And John Chas says, how would you answer that? And his response has two levels. First, he says, you answer out of desire. You want to give a good answer. That's why you'll be able to think up a good answer. He's making the point that there is a role for desire on the path. And then the second level of the answer, of course, is the time hasn't come to let go of the peel. I'll let go of the peel when the time comes. If I let go of the peel now, the banana turns into mush in my hands. In the same way, there are certain things you have to hold on to as part of the path. You hold on to right views, you hold on to right habits and practices, you hold on to a skillful sense of yourself. Otherwise, your path becomes mush. Your mind becomes mush. So you need these things to give form to the path. Okay, that was the first noble truth. The second noble truth is craving, which is the cause of suffering. And it's particularly three kinds of craving. Not all desire is bad, but there are three kinds of craving that the Buddha says lead to becoming. And because they lead to becoming, they're going to require feeding. In order to maintain an identity, you have to feed. And so any craving that basically requires that you feed is going to cause suffering. There are three types of craving the Buddha identifies. One is craving for sensuality, i.e. to think again and again and again about sensual pleasures. There's craving for becoming. You want to take on an identity. You want to take on an identity in a particular world. And there's craving for non-becoming, which is you have a particular identity that you don't like, you would like to destroy it. Now, the Buddha's insight was that even that last kind of becoming, last kind of craving, actually leads to more becoming. Because once you want to destroy an identity, you take on the identity of the destroyer. So this is one of the reasons why we have to find a way of looking at the world that doesn't look at it in terms of becoming, either creating a becoming or destroying a becoming. This is why we need the Four Noble Truths that look at things simply in terms of actions and results. So that's the second Noble Truth. The third Noble Truth is the cessation of suffering. And it's a simple truth that when you can put an end to that craving, then the suffering will stop. And the fourth Noble Truth is the path to sensation, which is the Noble Eightfold Path, which we're talking about this week. So those are the Four Noble Truths. But each of the truths, as I said, has a duty. In terms of the first Noble Truth, the truth of stress and suffering, you want to comprehend it. You want to abandon its cause, and you want to realize cessation, and you do that by developing the path. Those are the four duties. Comprehending suffering, abandoning craving, realizing cessation, and developing the path. And it's important that we don't confuse these duties. All too often when we encounter suffering, we don't take the time to comprehend it. We just want to get rid of it. We want to let go of it. But no matter how much you let go, it doesn't go away because you haven't let go of the cause. It's like going into your house, seeing that the house is full of smoke, and you just try to put out the smoke. No matter how much you put out the smoke, there's going to be more smoke coming because you haven't put out the fire. You have to find the fire. Put out the fire, the smoke will end on its own. In the same way, we have to comprehend suffering so that we can find, okay, what is causing it? Then you abandon the cause, and that will be the end of suffering. The third level of right view is called ultimate or final right view. This comes when you have completed the duties for the Four Noble Truths. But you realize that if you still hold on to the path, there will still be some clinging and there still will be some suffering. So at this point, in the words of Ajahn Mun, you look at all Four Noble Truths as one. In other words, it's simply things, stress arising, stress passing away, and you have only one duty, and that's to let go. So you're going to be letting go of all the factors of the path, from right view all the way down to right concentration. So here you have only one duty, i.e., developing dispassion for all of these things. Now it's important that as we look at these different levels of right view, once you're able to let go of all these things, you complete the duty with that level of right view. That leads to awakening. Awakening is basically a state which is a state of happiness that does not require feeding. Now it's important to realize that some people think if you stop feeding, it's going to be awful, that you're just suppressing your hunger. This is not the case. You've reached a happiness that is totally satisfying. You have no more need for becoming. You have no more need to feed. This happiness is that satisfying. Though it is the greatest happiness that people can find. Now sometimes when we talk about right view, you hear it defined in terms of what are called the three characteristics of inconstancy or impermanence. That's the first characteristic. Stress or suffering, that's the second. And not self is the third. Now it's important to realize though that the Buddha never talked about these as three characteristics. He talked about them as three different perceptions. And in terms of applying them, in terms of Four Noble Truths, you have to look at what level of right view you're dealing with, because these perceptions will play different roles. Basically, they're there to help you fulfill the duties of each of those levels of right view. For example, with mundane right view, the Buddha says you regard karma as your own, so you do not apply the perception of not-self to your karma. You look at other things of lesser importance. You focus on not identifying with things that would cause you to act in unskillful ways. In other words, if you're afraid that by observing the precepts you're going to ruin your health or you're going to ruin your wealth, you've got to learn to look at health and wealth as not-self so that you can maintain the practice of the precepts, and focus more on the long-term benefits of good karma. On the level of the Four Noble Truths, when you're developing virtue, and particularly when you're developing concentration, you apply the perceptions of inconstancy, stress, not-self, to things that would pull you away from concentration. But you don't apply them to the concentration itself. In fact, with the concentration, you're trying to make things constant, easeful, and under your control. So you're selective in how you apply those three perceptions on that level of right view as well. It's only on the ultimate level of right view that you apply the three perceptions to everything. so that you can let go of everything. But don't do that until you've completed the path. If you start applying ideas of inconstancy, stress, not self to the path, say you notice your concentration is inconstant and say, oh, that's an insight. You've used the perceptions in the wrong way. Apply them only to things that would pull you off the path as long as the path has not been fully developed. So that's right view.